Okay.
Because people often find my written works very difficult, one of the things that I've done over the years is to actually record a lot of audio things. So if you go on my website, you'll see over 60 audio recordings of talks I've given all over the place on various subjects, and they're indicated there. And very often people find this the most accessible way to get at what I'm on about. So let me start by addressing this topic, and I'm glad to see that most of the people in the room are of the younger generation, younger than me, certainly. And I want to say something about kind of what the promise was of going into history and philosophy of science in the first place, way back, you know, when Brian and I were students, you know, in the 1980s. And what's happened since then? Because in a sense, the promise hasn't been fulfilled. I think that's pretty straightforward. I mean, I don't know if anyone's lying about this over here, but the point is that there's a sense in which the aspiration of that field never really got realized. And in a sense, there's a bit of the same old going on. Okay, namely the idea that historians of science do their thing, the philosophers of science do their thing. Okay, and I think that was true when I began my career, and the idea of the field was to somehow synthesize this, and there were always these promissory notes that, you know, the professors may come from distinct disciplines and so forth, but if you're part of an HPS program, and I would say, by the way, the same more or less applies to STS as well, Science and Technology Studies, the sort of successor field, you might say, that you will be able to integrate things that your predecessors could not do. But this has not, in fact, happened for the most part. What I want to do here, I guess, in the beginning, is at least to say what made this very attractive, this history and philosophy of science thing. Why this field? Because I don't know how you think about history and philosophy of science today, to be perfectly honest. Because there was a time when it was seen as kind of a radical field. It was seen as kind of a radical field, okay? I mean, now I'm not so sure anymore. But the idea was that both the history and the philosophy would mutually interrogate each other's fundamental assumptions, right? That there's a sense in which the potential of the kind of knowledge that these fields can offer, in a way, are kind of restricted because they're operating within very specific sort of disciplinary boundaries. And you know, I'm someone who comes to it with a primarily philosophical interest and a normative philosophical interest. And you know, you may know that I've been very much associated with social epistemology over the last 25 years. We just celebrated our 25th anniversary, okay, of a journal I founded when I was waiting to defend my doctoral dissertation. Okay, it gives you a sense, you know, you got some downtime, you got to do something with your life, right? You know, found a journal, you know, why not? But the point is that this thing is still in existence now, 25 years later, and the idea was that philosophy, there was nothing wrong with the normative ambitions of philosophy, but you might say it was sort of empirically anorexic, right? I mean, in a sense that there wasn't enough input with regard to the actual practices of science, either historically or in the contemporary world. So the tendency was, already for a generation by the time Brian and I get on the scene, for people to just reproduce the same old examples in a very abstracted sort of way, and then sort of say, this is the nature of science, and this is how things should be governed. But that had no connection with the actual practices of science, which were, in fact, changing quite a lot during this period, in all kinds of ways. Okay, and that might be something we might talk about now. But the intention, I think, of history and philosophy of science, and certainly the intention of the thing that I called social epistemology, was that at the end, we would still keep the normative focus. Right? So in other words, when we talked originally about naturalizing philosophy of science or naturalizing epistemology back in the 1980s, what we were doing was to say, yes, we still have this normative focus that we're still concerned about what sort of knowledge ought to be produced, by what criteria, right, for whom, by whom, you know, questions that sort of cover what we would normally call epistemic, moral, political. That was still the goal. But we were going to take on board, as part of the constraints within which we operate, the empirical and historical aspects of science, which have been quite various and end up leading to all kinds of consequences that in a way challenge our sort of more taken for granted notions of what those norms should be. So if one has sort of abstract ideas about deductive nomological explanations or Hempel's notions of confirmation or whatever Bayes' theorem, you know, all these kinds of things, you know, you're forced to kind of confront obvious counterexamples, and then you have to sort of make some kind of judgment as to what do you do about that. Is it that the cases are in some sense eccentric to the norms, or do you in some sense have to reconstitute the norms to make those cases central to them? That is kind of what I thought was going to happen. Okay, it didn't happen. Not really. Right? Otherwise, we wouldn't be still using the same categories, certainly in the philosophy of science, as we were using when we were students. Okay? And there are still people who think, you know, you should start by reading Hempel. I mean, I was a student of Hempel at Pittsburgh in the tail end of his career. Okay? And very nice man. Perhaps the person who was actually the most careful critic of my work when I was a student. So logical positivism does have some pedagogical payoffs, in case people are wondering. Okay? But the point is, the guy's passed his sell-by date in terms of, you know, where the action is in terms of the theoretical foundations for the field. Yet we still kind of start this way. It's as if, not, you know, and very little seems to have changed. And whatever things have been introduced in a very resistant, reluctant, watered-down kind of fashion. Okay? And this fact itself has enabled science and technology studies to flourish as a field. Right? Because science and technology studies basically says, hey, we have no norms. The norms are just given by the cases. Right? So whatever scientists say they're doing and whatever passes as science, hey, that's great. And so there's so much stuff covered by that, and it's so exotic and so, you know, diversified and so forth, it looks like a very attractive field to move into. Right? Because they're not still operating with a sort of hamstrung sense of normativity that the logical positivists had and so forth. Okay? And so we have this field called science and technology studies, which, you know, which is a field I've been very much associated with. But a field that, you know, if you look at it from an empirical standpoint, has no scruples whatsoever. Right? And one of the reasons why this field succeeds as well as it does, and it does succeed very well, is because it's very policy relevant. So in other words, what science and technology studies primarily advertises is having methods by which we can understand what's happening in particular contexts with regard to how science and technology is produced. And that's very important for policymakers because there are, the context is so diversified, in many cases do not conform to sort of the usual norms by which science and technology are produced, at least from the standpoint of what's taught in the university. That becomes important. You actually have people who can access that stuff very well. Okay, and science and technology studies people are excellent doing this because, as Bruno Latour has canonized, follow the actors. Right? Start, in a sense, with a blank slate as the investigator and just be open to what you actually see and then represent that in the terms that makes most perspicuous sense of the context in the context. So there's no pretense to generalizability, universalizability, or anything of that sort. Okay? Now that is incredibly useful from a policy standpoint because policymakers are generally interested in fairly clear targets, right? We want to be able to administer for this kind of science or this kind of project and so forth. And so we need to understand how the people who are involved in it, you know, are doing the stuff. And we need to understand it kind of at the level at which they understand it. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that, okay? I don't think there's anything, as it were, morally wrong with doing that. The question is whether that becomes then the end of your inquiry. Right? For me, it's a means, not an end. But it is an end in science and technology studies that's normally constituted today. And so I think we are very much in the sort of the same situation as you know, the relationship between anthropology and imperialism. Okay? You know, anthropology as a discipline, certainly very clearly in the UK, also in France, I would say, was very highly developed because of the imperial idea. And the imperial idea was, you know, okay, we're governing all these countries, you know, all these places far away with different cultures. We need people who can get in the inside and understand what these people are on about, okay? And that makes that enables us to administer them better because then we kind of understand the language they speak, the ways they operate, and we can kind of persuade them in the terms they understand so they don't think we're coming on at them too heavy-handedly, right? And we can maybe co-opt some of them to become one of us, and we can start hybridizing their roles so they're partly native and partly us, right? Right? And that was what that's how imperialism worked, right? And that was why this was such a big business in the late 19th or in throughout most of the 20th century, both in Britain and in France, which were the two major imperial powers. Science studies basically follows this line, And so the fact that it calls itself an anthropology science should raise some alarm bells to people who know something about the history of anthropology, as opposed to real anthropologists who know nothing, right, about the history of anthropology. But if you're real, you know, if you know something about the history of anthropology, you should know, I've heard this story before. Okay, but it's not coming in, it's not coming quite from the same place, and the administrative interests aren't quite the same. Okay, but nevertheless, it is that kind of thing. To bring it sort of more, a little bit more back home, one of the things that we, that in science and technology studies, we very much valorize as a methodological tool, and maybe some of you in your courses may have run across this concept, grounded theory. You ever run across this? If you haven't, don't. But no, but the point is, this is a very important sort of idea. It comes from Anselm Strauss and people in San Francisco. San Francisco's University of California School of Medicine, San Francisco, 1960s, late 1960s. And it's a basically a kind of way of doing ethnography of medical context, right? Where you're dealing with patients, where you're dealing, you know, with all sorts of health kind of issues. Where it's quite clear, once again, right, that the natives of the asylums are like a foreign country, and you have to somehow understand them from their own standpoint. Why to do so? Well, so you can administer them better. Okay? And that's the context in which this kind of work originally came from in the late 1960s. Grounded theory, Anselm Strauss, classic kind of stuff. And so what does grounded theory mean? Grounded theory is the idea that the only kind of theory that you should be introducing when you're doing your ethnographic study is theoretical concepts that the agents themselves have originally volunteered. So in other words, part of what you're doing when you're actually interviewing them and doing the field work and stuff like that is to get a sense of, okay, how are they categorizing their world? Okay, and that then should provide you, the analyst, with the categories through which you should understand them. Okay, that's why it's grounded in their lives, not in your life. You don't have a life. You're just some ventriloquist or something. That's kind of the idea, right? You don't have a normative standpoint, right? You're just this articulator of what the people you're studying are saying. Okay? No muss, no fuss from a responsibility standpoint. Okay? Now, the kind of people who were funding this kind of research in the 1960s, were the Rockefeller Foundation, all these kind of, they were the ones funding the ethnographers to actually get in there and do that kind of stuff. And this then led to an enormous explosion within the sociology profession, because this was basically also being presented at a theoretical level as a challenge to the sort of kind of sociology being practiced in the United States in the late 60s, early 70s, which was the structural functionalism you may be familiar with, Talcott Parsons, Robert Merton, people of this kind. Okay, where in a sense, whatever else one wants to say about these guys, right, they invented their own theories, right? The theories came from their heads, they took responsibility for them, they're testing the hypotheses about other people, and in a sense they only regard the people they're studying as data for their theories against which their theories are either vindicated or not. Okay, but that's totally different from grounded theory, which basically said, no, that's oppressive, right? What's not oppressive is actually to adopt the categories of the agents and then represent them in your own text and sell them to the Rockefeller Foundation. Seriously, this is what happened. So you end up getting this enormous kind of explosion taking place at the Society for the Study of Social Problems. And this is a kind of a branch of sociology, social problems, already, you know, a lot of bells should ring. In 1970, Alvin Guldner, I don't know how many of you know who Alvin Guldner is. See, this is amazing. Alvin Guldner, well, he was a very important critical sociologist in the United States who wasn't beholden to Habermas or the Frankfurt School or anything, but looked at the state of sociology in the United States and decided to become critical. Okay, he understood Weber, he understood the whole tradition, and he wrote this very important book, which got reviewed in the New York Times, and it was one of the first books that entered my consciousness when I first started studying sociology in the 1970s, The Coming Crisis in Western Sociology. Okay, The Coming Crisis, and he was criticizing a lot of things going on, okay? He was criticizing Parsons and Merton and people like that, but he was also criticizing this stuff that I'm talking about here. And he became the president of the Society for Social Problems in 1970 and gave an amazing inaugural address, which basically completely castigated and deconstructed all of these people who thought that in some way they were being more objective by just adopting the categories of the agents they were studying. Whereas in fact what they were doing was delivering them on a platter to the people who were paying for the research they were doing. So this clientelism that Guldner saw had developed in sociology at the micro-sociological level, for him, he thought this compromised the integrity of the field, that sociologists did not have their own normative frameworks from which they operated that were independent from the subjects. Rather, what they were supposed to do is do a kind of surveillance operation on the subjects and then represent that as accurately as possible and then present it to the people who are funding their research. Okay? This is happening now in science and technology studies all the time. It's what makes this field so successful, because the field is, as it were, very methodologically sophisticated, but theoretically light, right? There's no clear theoretical commitment, okay? So, and the great genius of all this is Bruno Latour, because Bruno Latour operates at both levels at once, right? He's got this kind of theoretical stuff, you know, non-actors, actons, blah, blah, blah. And now a whole branch of philosophy has been spun off of this. You may have heard of speculative realism, right? Which is this kind of new scholasticism of where everything is kind of equally exists on the same plane of reality, right? No reduction, no hierarchy of metaphysics, but just everything at the same level of reality. And that exists completely independently of what, in fact, the method enables you to do, which is to really understand at a very close-grained level what people are up to, and then presenting that as policy reports by which governance can be made more intensive. Okay? And that's how this field has succeeded. Okay? So there is the normative character of the inquirer has disappeared entirely. Because if you're just talking the metaphysical side of, let's say, something like actor network theory, you don't really have to have strong normative commitments to the way society ought to be governed, because all you're talking about are entities, right? And it's all at this level of abstraction, right, that rises above where political decision-making matters. And if you're dealing with it at the methodological level, right, where you're studying actants in action and so forth, right, what you have to provide is a story that is suitable for the client who happens to be hiring you. You don't need to make a commitment there either. The commitment, in a sense, was already made when you signed the contract to do the research. Okay? But what's lacking between those things is some sense of a normative framework within which this greater understanding of the diversity of actors in the science and technology world should be understood. Okay? And that challenge really has not been taken up in any serious institutionalized way. I think one of the ways you see this is that last week I was at Copenhagen, and Copenhagen had the meeting of the Society for Social Studies of Science, as well as the European Association for the Study of Science and Technology. And every 2 years they meet together, and they met in Copenhagen last week, and I was there doing my stuff. The thing that's interesting about these professional associations, which have now grown, you know, to be beyond 1,000, they're fairly large, is the enormous amount of turnover. Okay, so in other words, there's not a strong affiliation with science and technology as a discipline, as a profession, but rather as kind of a marketplace where people can display what they're working on, and then they'll move on to something else, to some other professional meeting, depending on whatever grant they happen to be on next week. Okay, so in fact, the only people who tend to be kind of constant over the years are the older people, the people who in a sense had some sense of a vision of a profession or a discipline or something like that. But otherwise, what you have is this incredibly transient population of people, all of whom find this a very convenient place to present what they're doing. A friend of mine who has been working with me for many years, when he was at the airport going out of Copenhagen, he told me that he was sitting next to a relatively young person in science and technology studies, and this person struck up a conversation with him at CM at the conference, and the first question he asked him was, what's your case? What's your case? As if that's kind of the defining thing about your professional identity. What have you been working on? Right? What's the subject matter? Not what your theoretical perspective is, right? Not what your intellectual horizons are or anything like that. Why are you in the field? They don't even ask that question, right? They ask, what is your case? Okay? And I think this, in a sense, tells you, you know, what we see with science and technology studies today is very much, this field, as I said to you initially, is a successful field. Okay? A successful field in the sense that increasing numbers of people are paying attention to it, they are orienting themselves to it, they're picking up the lingo, right? They're going to the meetings. None of that, you know, I don't want to take away from that. But it is very much kind of a knowledge formation that is very much of our neoliberal times. Okay? As science technologies, so in other words, if you were a kind of Marxist, and I know Marxists don't exist anymore, but if you were a Marxist, right, that's a 19th, 20th century political movement that had all kinds of aspirations that just, you know, ended up leading to disaster everywhere. But, you know, and people try to erase it from the historical record, but it existed. It did exist, Marxism, okay? One of the things that Marxism had going for it was ideology critique, okay? And ideology critique was the idea that if you look at certain kinds of knowledge practices, right, and especially the ones that are flourishing in a very serious way, that if you want to explain why is it this field is making this kind of impact in the way it is in our world today, that it has something to do with being relatively well aligned with the dominant social and political forces of the time. Okay? And I think science and technology studies fits this to a bill in terms of our living in a neoliberal time. Okay? Because neoliberal times is basically about being thinking about knowledge not as something, and this is where I think if you don't quite get where I'm coming from here, I think you should read some of Friedrich von Hayek's early papers on the uses of knowledge in society from the 1940s, okay, which is very much, you know, which is kind of, you might say, the sacred text of neoliberalism. Again, I don't know if anyone here is a student of neoliberalism, but this is a real movement, neoliberalism, not just something that got cooked up by some journalists. And it's a movement that has been very much in brewing from the 1930s onward. And some of you may know about let me take a head count here. The Mount Pelerin Society. Does that mean anything to anyone? Okay, you may have heard. Okay, in the 1930s. Okay, starting in the 1930s. There were a group of people who identified themselves as liberals who were very worried that given the sort of financial crash, the 1929 stock market crash, all that kind of thing, the Great Depression, that there was a concern that socialists would take over the world. And that capitalism would have seen its last legs, and as a result, all of humanity would fall into the abyss. Okay? And so the question was going to be, how are we going to revive the fortunes of liberalism in the long term. And that's what makes this whole thing very interesting, because the neoliberal project was actually conceived back in the 1930s, okay, with this group called the Mount Pelerin Society, which was a kind of a relatively close society of philosophers and economists who were bankrolled basically by some big financial interests that sort of thought this was kind of an important thing to put a little money into. And so every year these people have been meeting. So you can go, you know, it's not a secret society, it's not like the Masons exactly, right? Though you can only be part of it through invitation, but it doesn't have a secret handshake or that kind of thing. But if you do a Google search, Mount Pelerin Society, P-E-L-E-R-I-N, right, named after a mountain in Switzerland where these guys used to meet, they meet in different places now. You see that part of what they were doing was to ensure that, you know, the longevity of the sort of free market economy and the sort of worldview that's promoted by that, against all of the recognized kind of booms and busts that obviously have taken place in the actual political economy of capitalism, which led to the Great Depression, and of course provides a kind of ongoing incentive for socialism. Right, so as long as capitalism is self-destructing, socialism looks good, right? And so the question is, how are we going to manage that to enable capitalism to continue to succeed without having this kind of socialist attractiveness whenever the capitalists fail? And that was what neoliberalism was originally about. And so Hayek was part of this originally. All of the people of the associated with the Austrian School of Economics, they were part of it. Okay, there were some liberal theorists part of it. Perhaps the most important one was Raymond Aron, the French liberal theorist. Karl Popper was part of it for a little while, but he got kicked out because he suggested that some social democrats should be invited to this. You know, so in other words, Karl Popper was making a distinction between the social democrats and the sort of Leninists out there, and for people like Hayek and others, that was a step too far. Okay, so these guys are hardcore, okay? Michael Polanyi was part of it. People who were part of, you know, Science for a Free Society, I don't know if you're familiar with this, a CIA-funded kind of group that Michael Polanyi was part of in the 1950s. They were part of the Mount Pelerin Society. I mean, these people do not hide this fact, okay? And the economic historian Philip Murawski, maybe you've heard of Philip Murawski? Well, you should. He's got an anthology out on the road to Mount Pelerin. That's what it's called. Harvard University Press came out a couple of years ago. A set of essays about all the people who've been involved in this and the impact they ended up having. So, for example, they had an enormous amount of impact in the coup in Chile when Pinochet overturned Salvador Allende, because Allende was a smart guy, and it looked like here we're going to get some, you know, damn competent socialists running the country. That's a nightmare, right, if you're trying to promote capitalism. All these other socialists are kind of crazy people, but this guy actually knew what he was doing. He brought in cyberneticians like Stafford Beer and so forth, and here you had the opportunity in early 1970s for a kind of rationalized social democratic style socialism to take place in Latin America for the very first time. We can't have that happening, right, if you're the CIA. And so the Mount Pelerin Society basically supplied all kinds of economists to go down to Chile, okay? And of course, the most prominent one who made the biggest noise, and some of you who are old enough may remember, Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman. If you don't know, Milton Friedman was the man, the point man, in the 1970s and 80s. Right, the public face, you might say, of that whole neoliberal thing, right? And he was the one who justified all the Reagan stuff and all the Thatcher stuff and stuff like that, right? By that time, Hayek was a grand old man getting the Nobel Prize in economics, right? But Milton Friedman was on the front line making the arguments, okay? So these people have had enormous kind of impact. So that what you see then is that when this you know, nominally right-wing governments, you know, Thatcher, Reagan, they get overturned in the 1990s, both of them, right? The governments that replace them, so whether we're talking about Blair or Clinton, are basically just carrying on the same old shit, right? They're carrying on the neoliberalism more intensively. They don't reverse it. There's no reversal, right? So this is the triumph of neoliberalism happens at that point, right? Where you end up getting the people who identify themselves as being progressive and with regard to the political possibilities that are available at the time are indeed the politically progressive people. They, in fact, just push forward the neoliberal reforms, okay? Now, there's a lot of work to be done, I think, in terms of actually investigating how this kind of thing happened, and Murawski's very much interested in doing that, and I think that's something worth one. But one of the things that was very clear about the neoliberals from the 1930s onward was that the old left-right thing will have to be changed, right? So for example, none of the neoliberals thought of themselves as being right-wing at all. None of them ever did. In fact, you know, Hayek, Friedman, you look at, to a person, anti-conservative. Because they want a radical change in society. A radical change that implies the enablement of markets dominating everything. And that is radical. If nothing else, that is radical. Right? Because that goes against all kinds of traditional social formations and so forth. So, in the 1990s, what we start to get is a neoliberalization of the university, which is, in a sense, at one level, the most conservative institution. Right, the least market susceptible institution around, right, and that happens, and the way this happens is through this proliferation of rhetoric, you might say, I mean theorized rhetoric about knowledge society, knowledge economy, right, very much part of both the academic rhetoric and also the policy rhetoric in the 1990s, cross-party rhetoric. Now there were some naive people in universities who thought, wow, great, you know, we're now saying that the economy is driven by knowledge, that society is driven by knowledge. That must be of some benefit to universities. Au contraire. No, what that means is that the concept of knowledge has been flattened. Right? So in other words, it has been brought to a level where it is possible for universities to be competing with online providers of teaching, with the think tanks, with the, you know, with science parks, you know, with R&D divisions of corporations. And sometimes this even went as far down as national funding, right? So in other words, when you, you apply for a grant, who are you competing against when you apply for a grant? Well, you normally think you're applying, you know, you're competing with other academics, but in fact, you may be competing with all these private guys who are competing for public money, because they might be able to provide whatever is demanded more efficiently, in some sense. Okay? So this is what happens in the 1990s. Now, in that context, the university, as a privileged site for the production and distribution of knowledge, disappears. It disappears not simply from the rhetoric, but from the consciousness of the people in the institution. Okay? And I think one of the ways in which you see this is people think of themselves in terms of the research they do. Right? In terms of how they relate to their universities, well, you know, it's resistance, right? People only want to come in a couple of days a week. They want to make sure the car parks are working, but other than that, they don't worry about the university they think of it as a physical place, basically, right? They don't think of it as an institution with a concept that is responsible for promoting knowledge indefinitely, generation after generation. They don't think of the university that way at all. They think of it as a place, and a place that in some sense is administered by these deans and vice chancellors and people of this kind. But those people very often get in the way. They're kind of nuisances, right? They push paper in front of you that you have to read and do something about, right? So there's an oppositional character that has developed within the university itself between the identity of the ordinary academic who sees themselves primarily as a researcher, maybe a teacher, but in a valorized sense as a researcher, and the people running the place who were seen as these obstacles to my being able to do what I want. And so when people start thinking about, well, where do you get your identity as an academic? It's no longer an identity with the institution that you happen to be paying your salary, but rather it's with the networks, my networks, and they go everywhere. They are far and flung, right? And they go well beyond the boundaries of the university. And they could be anywhere. The farther, the better. And what happens then is the institution just loses its salience altogether as a site for normative interest. Okay? And we demonize, not only that, we demonize the people who dare go into administration. The people who go into becoming deans and vice chancellors and all that other kind of stuff, we think of these people as failures, right? This is kind of like the dignified way out. Okay? And this is a real nightmare because, look, I do not believe that we can really ever get back to a kind of, quote, collegial system where academics govern themselves or anything like that. That's not where I'm going with this argument. Where I'm going with this argument is, yes, universities are very complex institutions, and no ordinary academic can be thought of as necessarily competent to manage such a complex institution. And if you need any persuasion on this point, you can go back to 1960, Clark Kerr, The Uses of the University, where the concept of the multiversity gets coined. This is kind of, in a way, a relatively positive normative model for the situation that we're in now, which unfortunately is in a degenerate state. Okay, so Clark Kerr, in case you don't know, was the man who masterminded the University of California system, which, you know, it's got this incredible kind of articulated levels of, you know, you've got the sort of top research universities, you've got the other universities that are more teaching oriented, and then you've got the kind of community college level. And so the idea is through that whole complex system, you incorporate all of the citizenry eventually into the higher education process. But that's a very complicated thing. It involves managing many different kinds of demands. And there's no reason to think that an ordinary professional academic could ever be good at doing that kind of stuff. But the point then becomes, you need the people who are indeed competent to do that kind of stuff. And you need to train them, respect them, and recognize them. And that managing a university isn't simply a matter of, you know, finding someone who in his past life has managed something of similar scale and scope. That is to say, okay, I ran a company before that basically has a certain kind of revenue turnover that's very similar to the university, or I've managed as many people on staff as before, and I'm really good at cutting staff. You know, I mean, that is not sufficient requirement. But unfortunately, it is increasingly becoming the case that the kinds of qualifications that we're looking for when we go for academic administrators are ones that are very similar to the corporate world. And that the distinctiveness of the university as an institutional, as an organizational formation, is ignored. And who is to blame for this? I do not blame the Mount Pelerin Society. God bless them, they got their agenda. I blame us, okay? Because we have bought into this agenda so much, right, that we think of our own identities as academics purely in terms of our own specific research interests, and we don't care, in a way, who is running our universities, as long as they don't interfere with what we're trying to do, okay? And that is the neoliberal horizon in which we find ourselves today. And science and technology studies placed this extremely well, because in a sense, all you have when you're science and technology studies is you have methods. And you can apply those methods anywhere. Any university, research units, I mean, you're a movable feast, okay? You can go anywhere, right? You can go anywhere and you can be institutionally indifferent. You have no commitment to the future of the university, okay? And so in this respect, science and technology studies is the great success story of the ascendancy of the neoliberal political economy. There's no other field I can think of that has succeeded so well in this context. Okay? And if the university goes down the tubes, you know, as they may well, and I think one of the interesting, you know, harbingers of this you might want to look at is go to Chile. I don't know how many, I've been there, I've given lectures. What does the Chilean higher education system look like? Every university sets itself up as a kind of stall. So the front part of the university, which may be a relatively small building actually, because they have enormous numbers now, because it's a market environment, you got hundreds of them proliferating all over the place, and they're all kind of claiming to be able to provide certain kinds of skills that you will need to get a job certain places. And you see billboards all over Santiago basically advertising this kind of thing, okay? And what role does the government play in this? What role does the state play in this? Because it's incredibly liberalized, incredibly privatized. The state has a specific role. And this is where neoliberalism differs very much from classical liberalism. The state has a very specific role, and that is consumer protection. In other words, if you advertise, you come to our university, you get a degree from us, we can get you a job. And that, of course, is an obvious selling point in this kind of market environment. Then if you can't get them a job, you can sue the university and the state will back you. Okay? Now, there was last year there was a major student revolt in Chile. Okay? And there was a tendency, I think, in Northern Hemisphere, at least, to kind of misunderstand what the nature of the student revolt is. Because when students revolt against tuition fees and stuff like this in England and elsewhere, right? One imagines that these students are thinking about, that they have a right to education. This is something that empowers them as human beings. Why should there be financial barriers be put in front of them? But this is not what was happening in Chile. No, it was rather, I wasn't getting my money's worth. Right? And there were too many universities who had been licensed in Chile through the neoliberal regime who were not delivering on the promises that they offered. And so the students were having a consumer revolt. Okay? That's a totally different motivation for revolting. But that is the neoliberal system, you see? And neoliberalism enables this to happen, and in fact, maybe even encourages this to happen, because what the neoliberals will provide as far as the state is concerned is not the minimal state of the libertarians, it's not that state, it's rather a kind of regulatory state, but you know, one that that basically tries to maintain transparent transactions between buyer and seller. And if people are hiding something or saying something false, they will be caught by the state. But beyond that point, it is up to you to decide what you're going to do. Now, I think that's an important thing for people that kind of drum into their heads about neoliberalism, right? That neoliberalism is not an anti-state view, but is one that has a very specific view about the role of the state's function in otherwise a free environment, which is consumer protection. I know a lot of people think consumer protection is a positive thing, but when that becomes the primary way in which the state relates to people, You see, then it becomes very difficult to establish the kind of normative basis on which you want to talk about the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake, for future generations, for the long term, beyond what can actually be sold at the in the marketplace at the moment. Okay? Now, for science and technology studies, this doesn't matter very much, because science and technology studies is not a discipline with a paradigm that is trying to solve its own research programs. Rather, science and technology studies is a set of methods that can be deployed in multiple settings to whomever happens to need them. So it's very market-friendly in that respect. It doesn't impose, you know, one of the reasons why it's very difficult for Marxists to get research grants is because Marxists come in with a heavy theoretical baggage, right? You know, they say, yes, I'm happy to do research on you, but you're exploiting the people who you're talking about, and that's going to be part of the explanatory narrative that I'm going to be providing for you. But under those circumstances, I'll take your money, but the point is, you know, I'm going to damn you while I write about you. Okay, that's a normative perspective, okay? Yeah. But science technology studies doesn't have any of that. There is no normative, prior normative commitment that the researcher is bringing to the thing. Rather, the researcher is just presenting him or herself as, I'm a tool for you. I am a living toolkit. Use me as you will. That is the selling point, okay? Now you see, when we get to that kind of, what happens to knowledge when you're putting yourself in that position? There is no autonomy of knowledge production, right? There's no sense of where is knowledge going as any kind of collective project where we're building on, you know, previous generations and so forth. Because the whole thing about the market is, the market is as it were, a sequence of ephemera, right? Things change, transactions change, people's tastes change, there, you know, anything goes with regard to what influences those changes. And so there's no real sense of accumulation in the sense of accumulated knowledge, right? So in fact, for anyone who is kind of a market-based model, one of the big challenges always is collective learning. In whose interest is it to provide a kind of collective learning base for something where the transactions are so distributed, right? Where everybody, as it were, makes their own choices, lives with their own consequences, and so forth. Who would exactly have an interest in collective learning? Traditionally, the people who have had an interest in collective learning are people who have a vision of humanity or knowledge that goes beyond just the transactions of everyday life. Who, in a sense, think, well, you know, actually, we're trying to train up people. We are trying to make people better. That there is a sense in which knowing about the history of something actually might inform you to sort of make more intelligent decisions and shouldn't be just left to whatever you happen to pick up while you're interacting with other people in your own lifetime. That was the whole point of having state-based education systems, okay? And before the states were doing it, the churches were doing it. In other words, the whole idea of having education as any kind of systematic collective project was always driven by some sort of overarching ambition that went beyond just the combination of transactions taking place in a given market environment. Okay? And so in that respect, the churches and the state are just sacred and secular versions of the same thing, both of which are opposed by the neoliberal regime that we're in now. And I really, you know, those of you who are interested in Friedrich von Hayek, you know, you get his collected works. They have been lovingly edited by the Liberty Fund in Indianapolis. And you just go and you do a search on the word university, word knowledge, you know, any of those kinds of things, and you will see relentless, deconstructive, skeptical attitudes toward that. Okay? And I think this is kind of where we are now. We are now, as it were, living in the situation that guys like him were imagining back in the 1930s. And that is, I don't mean to be such a downer about this, Brian, because I want to open up the discussion. But I think in terms of what has happened, this is what's happened. And I think this is pretty, you know, and I'm presenting this story with the historical perspective there. But someone who knows something about the history, this is what we're, where we are looks like now. And I'll open it up.
have any HPS programs come online in the last 20 years that you know of?
No.
Any gone away?
I'm amazed that they've stayed in existence. You know, so Indiana, Pittsburgh, you're here. You know, I mean.
But none.
Cambridge is still there.
Yeah. STS programs, many.
Well, they
it became an STS program. Was it a history?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, yeah, they do float in and out of existence. And of course, the tricky part, and this was the part, you know, I was at Virginia Tech where we were actually conceptualizing science technology studies as a discipline with a kind of specific institutional location in the university. So we actually had a kind of proper academic ambition, and it's still doing that. So I don't take that away from the people there. But I think that the kinds of science and technology studies programs that have been most visible and most successful are the ones that have much looser aspirations. So in other words, they're kind of programs where nobody would be tenured directly into it, but would rather come from different fields, and the students entering into the program would see themselves as picking up skills from the different fields and then doing what they will with it.
Yeah, like centers like at York.
Yeah. San Diego would be another one. UC San Diego. Yeah. I mean, I don't mean to be such a downer about these things, but I think, you know, you might as well find out what's happening.
I would have said that when I go to somewhere like 4S or I meet people, but there are young and older people who are more normative and more, or they're maybe not non-normative, but maybe they have a political agenda, and they're trying to reimagine whatever field they're attacking in some political way. And I mean, that sounds like what you're describing.
No, but the field itself is not doing it, right? The field itself doesn't have that. Of course, the field is readily available for people to use it as whatever way they will. And so that's why there's a high turnover of people who go to those meetings. Because sure, there'll be some politically active people who are doing some very interesting things, but the politics and normative perspective come from outside the field. Yeah. And they're using the professional meeting as a forum, as a market. To advertise themselves, essentially, you know, and they may be doing very nice things. I'm not denying they're doing nice things, but the point is, the field itself is not progressing through that, because the field itself is just functioning as a receptacle. It's not functioning as a profession with an autonomous body of knowledge that might develop. And I think we really need to be careful about that kind of thing. Yes, sir.
It seems that you are saying that the success of STS is due to its affinity with neoliberal mentality. However, is there no chance for rupture of
Well, I mean, I to be honest with you, I don't. I think the best strategy, and Murawski and I have talked about this. He's got a book, by the way, coming out next year called "Never Let a Dire Crisis Go to Waste" with Verso Books. And his argument is basically neoliberalism just goes from strength to strength through crisis after crisis, and that neoliberalism is not going to disappear. I think the thing is, we have to sort of treat neoliberalism the way in which Marx treated capitalism. Okay, and if you understand something about the history of socialism, one of the things you'll see is that among the various flavors of socialism that were available in the 19th century, Marxism was perhaps, well, certainly it was, one of the friendliest to capitalism, right? Insofar as it believed that socialism could not come about unless you built upon capitalism, right? In other words, you don't turn the clock back, you don't go back to some medieval guild bullshit, you know? You don't do a Karl Polanyi. You know, some of you may know Karl Polanyi, and he's very kind of flavor of the month guy now. You know, kind of nostalgia, oh, what it would have been like if we didn't actually go through the Industrial Revolution. Sorry, we went through it, okay? And I think there's a sense in which we've gone through neoliberalism as well, and neoliberalism is going to be part of the groundwork on the basis of which some future kind of socialist project would be built, okay? And so I think we should follow the example of Marx in that respect. If you think about how Marx conceptualized his socialism vis-a-vis the economic situation that he was living in, right? What is noticeable in comparison to the other socialisms of the time was the extent to which he built upon capitalism, he did not deny capitalism, right? So in other words, the whole idea of the capitalist mode of production enabling work to be done more efficiently and so forth, he loved that part. The problem is, why should workers be exploited if that's in fact the natural tendency? And this is where you want to change then the sociology of the relations to the mode of production. Right? And that was what Marx was about. But he wasn't denying capitalist mode of production in terms of the drive toward a greater efficiency and so forth. And I think we need to engage in a similar kind of thinking with regard to the sort of neoliberal version of capitalism being presented now. That in a sense we have to take this as the groundwork, but then move it in a totally different direction from where it's moving now. But what I think is not productive is to engage in kind of these nostalgic gestures, you know, Slavoj Žižek world, right? Where you're sort of mouthing the old Marxist words, you know, as it were before, you know, but most of what you're talking about is movies, right? And you're talking about it to other people who don't do politics but do movies, right? And hence Occupy Wall Street. I mean, that is a waste of effort. Come on, if we're talking about how we're going to change the world in some substantive, radical way, the first thing you have to think about is how you organize people. Where the Marxists were really good was the fact they didn't believe in self-organizing groups. Right, that's just for the bourgeoisie. You know, people have a lot of time on their hands and they see a few things on a website and they get together someplace and they hold up a lot of placards and they invite a big name to come in and they get a couple of photo ops. That doesn't change anything, okay? What does change something, and what the Soviets were good at and all this, is they actively organize people. In other words, you got people who go out of their way to put people together and say, look, you should think about this way. You know, massive teaching, you know, kind of, this is what enabled Marxism to have the force that it did. It wasn't because it took for granted that people will somehow realize, you know, once things got bad enough, that there's a problem and that they should do something about it. No, it won't. That doesn't work that way. Okay? If you want to see a precedent for why that doesn't work, 1848. The liberal revolutions of 1848 in Europe, which followed up in the rise of a kind of liberal media where you had a lot of press freedom taking place in Europe, and you got a lot of people making a lot of noise, right? And people did all kinds of little revolts and things, and there was a clampdown after that. Okay? And that's where Marx's Communist Manifesto comes on the back of that, saying what was wrong about that. Well, I think our social media generation is in a way in that 1848 setup. Because the social media thing has this kind of superficial sense of, oh my God, I'm making noise, people are seeing me, I'm going to overturn regimes. And maybe you do overturn regimes, but that doesn't mean you end up getting to a better state as a result. No, rather you fall victim to the people with more power who actually know the same technologies that you know. Okay? And if you want to, you know, Evgeny Morozov, The Net Delusion. The Net Delusion. If you don't know about that work, it was a bestseller in the New York Times last year about basically a kind of skepticism that the way in which we're going to get to some kind of whatever might be post-neoliberal world is going to be through social media. Because social media is no different than newspapers in the 19th century. Okay, unless you actually have real political organization, right, you're just going to be seen as making a lot of noise and having a safety valve. And Marx knew this. And if you read Communist Manifesto closely, right, you will see Marx is making references to the failures of the 1848 revolutions. Sorry, I didn't mean to go
there. Yeah, thanks, Steve. We've been talking a lot about STS.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, we talked a little bit about HPS, and that hasn't really been flourishing as a unified field, or never has been a unified field. Haven't been new HPS departments in recent memory. So what can we learn from the case of STS about HPS?
Well, look, I think HPS does as well as it does, largely because I think it's institutionally pretty protected. Okay, in a sense, you know, if you think about the period when the HPS departments began, okay, so we're talking the Cold War period for the most part, that was a period when, in fact, universities were flourishing. Right, where they were expanding, they were most open to interdisciplinary initiatives that were university originated. Because now we have interdisciplinarity happening in the universities, but it's not necessarily being the source of the interdisciplinarity is not necessarily the university itself; it's the outside world. But actually, in the Cold War period, universities were growing, and there was a need among the academics felt there was a need to kind of have this kind of interdisciplinary stuff. And this was not just true with HPS, but area studies, ethnic studies, women's studies, all these sorts of things that are products of the Cold War era was a period when universities were expanding. And the demand for interdisciplinarity was internal. It was part of a critical self-reflection of the academics who were being given all kinds of money from the state, okay, and didn't really have to worry about where the next, you know, paycheck was coming from. They then came up with these things. And HPS happens to be fortunate, you might say, historically, of having to come about in that time. But STS, in fact, is a you might say, primarily post-Cold War kind of phenomenon. Okay? And there, the political economy of knowledge production changes, where universities are, in fact, getting less and less state funding, and where research has to be increasingly justified in terms of external funders and things like this. And that then changes the whole pitch with regard to what is the basis for your field. Okay? So we're, I think with HPS, because HPS was in this relatively buffered kind of academic environment, there's always been allowed people to think, well, you know, to do history of philosophy of science, you have to be a good historian, a good philosopher, because the standards of those fields really matter, because those disciplines actually have a lot of power within the university in terms of directing the way in which knowledge is produced. But we actually live in a different world now, where in a sense the power of disciplines to actually control over how knowledge is produced is falling apart. Okay? And maybe the humanities are the last bastion of this, okay, of this old view. But the point is, as a matter of fact now, there is no particular value in defending disciplinary integrity. What there is a value in is showing that you have methods that work. And that's a different matter altogether. Because when you're talking about disciplinary identity, you're talking about what are the real problems of the field. You know, so like, for example, a couple of years ago, Peter Galison did this thing, and this is how you could tell that somebody's at Harvard, right? He said, history of science, here are the 10 main problems of history of science. Yeah. And he was trying to have like a Hilbert program. It's like, God, you live in Gaga land, man. I mean, you know, it's great. That's great. Wonderful. I wonder how many people are ever going to even be in a position to take this proposition seriously. This is like a kind of nostalgic gesture, right, to a university that maybe exists at Harvard, but doesn't exist in many other places. Okay? So, because the point is, if you're defining your research agenda, right, and you really want to survive in the job market, yes, there are still places for people who are very academically oriented and who take somebody like Peter Galison seriously, but you've got to be enormously competitive. You've got to be enormously, and you've got to outproduce what the previous generation did, and that's a really hard thing to do, because those few people who are still trying to uphold academic standards, they're more tight-ass than ever, because they realize they're under siege. Okay? And so those of you who think the Peter Galison world's a real world, you know, God bless you, okay? But then there's a problem, you've got two options, right? One option is just to say the university is just a movable feast. I may work there, I may not, and I just want to develop whatever skills I can to be able to make myself as marketable as possible. That's one way to go. And the other way to go, which is kind of the way I'm sort of suggesting it, we have to reinvent the university in the new environment. But that means committing to the institution and actually getting some people who think of their career trajectory as moving at some point into things like deanships and rectorships and things like that, and not just being researchers. Because being just a researcher is really a very narrow way of thinking about academic life. Yeah.
So let's accept that neoliberalism is around, the university has sort of been demolished as an institution or self-contained culture. HPS, if we're going to survive, we need a product to sell. Here's at least one. But basically, we need something.
No. I think as a first approximation, this is exactly the way you need to think about it.
Okay, so here's a proposal for one of the products that we've got that people actually need. There's a genuine need for this thing that we've got going on. We are the ones that know how the sciences fit together.
Yes.
The history of the sciences. Yes. We know sort of like the large scale picture.
Yes. Yes.
And we're training hyper specialists in all across the sciences, and we're training humanities students. Don't know a thing about science.
Exactly.
And there's a real felt knowledge demand in the university for somebody
yes.
to get these worlds together. Somebody who can read equations and write paragraphs.
Yes.
And that's us. That's the thing
yes.
that we have.
So, yes. Good. Thank you. I agree.
We're working on it. But
are we working? Are we working? I mean,
for example, this used to be a graduate unit. The institute, IHPSD, was exclusively for training graduate students who would go and attack the 10 biggest problems of history, science, and
life. Yeah.
And now we're reconfiguring ourselves as also an undergraduate institution. So we teach courses.
Yes, undergraduates, yes.
We teach the courses, so there's a requirement on science students, you must have at least one humanities credit. There's a requirement on humanities student, you must have one science
yes.
credit. And they both come to our classroom, and they get the same curriculum, and it serves both.
Excellent. No, this is good. This is a very practical, yes. And in fact, you know, you may know, I wrote this enormous book on Kuhn a few years ago. And James Brian Conant, the president of Harvard who hired Kuhn, right? This man, whatever else one wants to say about him, because he was like this great Cold War magus, right? I mean, he got this, right? He got this. That the need for people entering into the post-World War II era, that everyone, regardless of what they're studying, needs to have this kind of overview of the history and philosophy of science, that should be required as part of general education, right? Not Latin, Greek, whatever, but this. Right? This was part of the idea, right? And he was absolutely right in pushing this, okay? Absolutely right in pushing this. And I agree with you 100%, and I'm glad there's at least one person thinking about this. Now, seriously.
I'm not the only one. There's a lot of people.
No, but it's got to be publicized more. And one of the things that Conant did you know, was to try to seed the idea at other institutions. So he was the kind of guy who actually went around to Amherst and Williams College and all these other places and said, you should have this too. Very few takers.
Yeah, and McGill, he went there.
Yeah.
We have to surrender the room soon, so we only have time for one more question.
So I just wanted to follow up on that. I agree with that, undergraduate education, or education per se, as opposed to research per se, research and scholarship should be integrated at the university. But you were talking about this normative framework.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just don't want to be zombies. You don't want to
That's
be,
right.
You know, there is these zombies that are floating around in California. They're parasitized. And they do all the same stuff, but they do it in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they run out into, you know. But, so where do you get that normative framework? And I just want to paraphrase that by contrasting it with medicine. So medicine is not a discipline. It's a whole series of disciplines. But there is this, I mean, there are these contested normative frameworks, but still a large percentage of physicians, even academic physicians, have this idea that they want to do good.
Yeah.
And they experience it. You know, they see it on a daily basis. You know, if they go into a clinic, they can do good. And you know, this year's Nobel Prize was for an algorithm that could be applied in places where markets don't work.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was the matching up of residents to residencies.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, everyone, despite, it's not really a market. You know, everyone, every hospital and every setting has their own sort of interpretation of what a good doctor is. And they're trying to place that. So could this institute or even our institute, the Knowledge Design Institute, or the Faculty of Information, who are looking at this meta level, looking at the process as opposed to the content. What is the normative framework to say that this is good science, or you know, or that the processes that are happening are productive, you know, because of history, because of philosophy, because of
this goes back to when Brian and I first met back in Virginia Tech, because the whole pretext of this conference where we met at was trying to come up with some naturalistically responsive normative theory of progress. Right? And I think this term progress needs to be revived, right? And it's a tricky term. And one of the things about the postmodern condition is basically to kind of deconstruct that idea so you're portrayed as kind of an imbecile if you actually think, well, where should this be going? So what do you mean, where should this be going? We don't know where we're going to go next week. I mean, let alone the long term, right? And so all of this uncertainty mongering, I mean, there's a whole lot of discourse that kind of, as it were, kicks up dust against the idea of thinking about progress. But I think we have to revive that kind of idea in the current context. See, neoliberalism doesn't have to believe in progress, right? Because they say, people just make their decisions and they suffer the consequences, blah, blah, blah. But there's nothing collective we need to worry about, right? And to worry about collective stuff is authoritarian. But I think we have to revive that kind of idea, you see? This idea of progress. And this was kind of what Loudon's project was about. He was kind of the last guy, really, who, within the mainstream of our field, really took that seriously.
Maybe John Morrow.
Yeah, well, he's not so important. I mean, but Loudon actually took this as a kind of collective project where he was actually bringing in philosophers and historians from other places to think about this collectively. But I think that's what you need. You need to revive the notion of progress.
So one way forward to progress or possibly is to contemplate the Summer Institute.
Yes. Yes, indeed. No, that would be the idea. Yes, so, you know, what does progress, you know, does the concept progress look like? Taking on board all of the various issues that have taken place. Because look, Brian and I, we're talking about something that happened 25 years ago, right? The world has changed massively in that time. But that doesn't mean that the normative impulse is still, you know, it is worth reviving. And we need really, and especially younger people, to get involved in this. You know, so I'm very much in support of that. I'm a very positive guy, actually. See, I don't know what you think about it, but I'm very positive because, you know, that's one of the things that keeps me living, you see, because if I believe things were so awful, I would just want to end it right now. But
okay, well, thank you very much for coming. Great talk.
Thank you.
Thank you.